Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by It's For Women. You are not 9 to 5 and neither are we. Conveniently open online 365 days per year, 24 hours per day.
Friends, and welcome to the podcast. Follow us on Spotify right now and you'll get this every single week. It's a selection of my favourite chats from the last few days as a warm ear hug for you. On this week's episode, the Dáil bike shelters shed load of money. We also have bodybuilding, Robert Harris on Britain's bonking Prime Minister who's not Boris, and the Kildare kid who's had to quit the GAA over racism, but he was saved by breakdancing. So first up, we brought you the details of the silly scandal of the Office of Public Works' €335,000 bike shelter outside the Dáil that got the country talking. It was a story that came out last weekend. We kind of elevated it on Monday and it went all around the place. And I also bring you through some of the state body's greatest cock-ups, which will make you sad, angry and laugh all at the same time. After that, we meet Tricia Rooney. She's a Wexford woman doing incredible things as a bodybuilder. Her story also touches on domestic violence, so it was a very serious chat. However, she's doing really, really well, I'm glad to say, and is in such a happy place, the conversation actually ended discussing the curse of getting fake tan off. So she was really, really lovely. After that, Robert Harris. What can we say? I'm a big fan of the man, and his new novel is the true story of a crazy love affair between Britain's wartime leader and a 26-year-old socialite. That's the Great War, the first one, if you know what I mean. It's really wild, and there's lots about Ireland in it, so it's great. We also chatted about his working class upbringing, and that was very interesting. I think you'll come away a big fan of Robert Harris if you're not already. And at the end, you'll hear the chat with Toby Omotesho, who's a Nigerian-Irish B-boy. That's breaking or breakdancing to you and I. He came to Kildare as a child. His dad was a nurse, and he was full of beans on the show, I can tell you. Toby is now working as an engineer in Limerick, but dancing is his religion, and he had great stories about being the only black kid on a Gaelic football team. That was the bad of it, but he is rescued by his love of dancing, so it ends on a cheerful note. And that is everything in the podcast. I'll be back on the wireless soon, RTÉ Radio 1, 9 a.m. till 10 every weekday. So let's start the weekend podcast. Journal.ie, Ken Fox, who's a specialist in freedom of information. He's a great story about the bike shed they built in Leinster House. And he discovers, by the way, it stores 18 bikes. Now, the background of this story is that Labour leader Ivana Bacik was pushing for new bike shelters at Leinster House. But the Ceann Comhairle said, no, we won't get planning permission because the existing facilities are not even being used. Nobody's bringing their bikes into the Dáil or the Shannon. So they built the bike shed. It cost €335,000 to store 18 bikes. Well, it will if they actually show up. A breakdown from the cost from the Office of Public Works shows €322,000 on the construction and installation of a shed. Another about €3,000 spent on archaeological services, €3,000. And then €10,000 on the quantity surveying services and what they're calling contract administration services. There's a lovely quote here. They asked about the costs. A spokesperson for the OPW said, and I'll say it in the way that it's intended,
the bicycle shelter is a new structure located within the setting of Leinster House, a protected structure of national importance. So setting a well-designed structure when the properties of high-quality materials and finish were required.
€333,000 for a bike shed. Now, you can buy a heavy-duty bike storage shed, we looked it up, for €850 on DublinGardenSheds.ie. And that'll hold, put three or four bikes in each of those. €850, there you go. So that could have saved a few quid. This country. Now, bicycles are a good idea, by the way, but just in Ireland, we have good ideas sometimes. We just do them in the wrong place, at the wrong time, in the wrong order, at the wrong price. And then when it goes wrong, nobody will admit, oh yeah, we got that wrong. Sorry about that. Is this the world's most expensive bike shed? Is just one of the headlines we're looking at. Now, yesterday morning, you might remember if you were following us, we mentioned journalist Ken Fox's story, a freedom of information story that he got about the Dáil bicycle shed, which cost €335,000. It had been a bit of an overlooked yarn across the weekend, and that we brought it to you. Our text machine duly exploded in reply, so we sort of knew this was a nerve-touching matter. And then it gathered steam online, and there was political response to it yesterday. And today, it's a very big story indeed. In fact, the update on the story, which you will know if you watched the 9 o'clock news on telly last night and saw an image of this structure, is that it's not even a shed. It has no walls, no door. It's kind of like a bus shelter. And it doesn't even protect the bikes from the elements. So for €335,000, I think we were half expecting a semi-detached or detached little cottage. No, it's a glorified lean-to made from steel, glass and what they're calling Irish granite in the attempts to explain the incredible price of this whole thing. It is a wonderful story of calamitous overspending when it comes to tax money. And it really kind of sums up yet again how we're not really fit to run ourselves, let's admit it. We are the home of the most expensive hospital, home of the most expensive Oasis tickets, and now the home of the most expensive bicycle shed-ish sort of thing, a kind of spenny shelter. It holds 18 bicycles, but there was only one in it when we saw the footage yesterday, and it was a wet day in Dublin yesterday. One single solitary bicycle. And let's remember, as we said, the Count Corla had said the existing bike parking in Leinster House wasn't really being used. Now, we're looking at an online post by the political director at the Labour Party. His name is Cathal McCann, and he tweeted that the single bicycle that you saw in the news was his. My bike, enjoying its new deluxe home in Leinster House, plastered all over RT News this evening. In all seriousness, it's not even properly sheltered, so I've no idea how it costs €335,000, even if it included other groundworks or the e-car chargers beside it, which we don't know is part of the spend. Cathal then goes on to say that the new shelter is a bit of a distance from the side door used by a lot of staff in Leinster House. So many still use the bike stands beside the Merrion Street gate. And he says the Kildare Street side has become overcrowded since some of the bike stands were taken out. And he concludes, what most of us who cycle into Leinster House for work have been asking for many years are the bike stands located beside or close to the entrances, preferably covered. Instead, we get a white elephant that will damage the cause of trying to deliver active travel infrastructure across the country. And as I say, it's been gathering legs because the because Eamon Ryan, the Green Party leader, and he's the outgoing Minister for Transport. He's the former Green Party leader now. He said questions need to be answered, but he doesn't say who should answer those questions or what those questions should be. But presumably he means the Office of Public Works responsible. And he doesn't say which. The fact that he doesn't say which questions or who should be directed kind of highlights how elected ministers are scared of the real power in this country, which is the permanent government, the civil service. And so I think it's worth looking at the OPW. It's the Office of Public Works. It does generally a good job of looking after civic buildings and heritage around the place. Heritage Week we just had in August, and that's wonderful. And they're also involved in Culture Night too, because it involves so many of our state buildings. They do good things. However, the OPW has a long history of unbelievable cock-ups, and many of them are very, very similar. And the outcome is usually the same. There's not much accountability for the wondrous wastage of taxpayers' money. We put together a hit list of the very best OPW calamity shambles for you this morning. The Department of Health is a great one. You remember the very ugly building they had down there beside the former Screen Cinema? Hawkins House is what they called. Well, they got a new building, and there was a bit of a botched project to rent the new headquarters, which is now on Baggot Street. And it meant the way they put it together meant the building remained empty for 16 months after the lease was signed at a cost of €16 million. But that's not the best bit. The best bit is there was a €10 million rental overpayment after the floor space was mismeasured by the OPW. The chairman at the time admitted nobody at board level had any qualification in property valuation whatsoever. The next thing was the OPW's job. They had to find a new Dublin command centre for the Gardaí in Dublin. Yes. And it was a series of kind of ham-fisted efforts here, selecting from a variety of buildings. They ended up choosing a building that wasn't actually in any of the original preferred choices, and it turned out to be too small for purpose. As the building had held 200 fewer personnel that were in the old building the Gardaí were moving from on Harcourt Street. And the OPW excuse was that the process took a bit longer than expected, and the numbers they actually put together were correct when the move was first kind of envisaged 6 to 8 years earlier. So there was an error, no accountability there. And by the way, when they were moving from Harcourt Square, the OPW had a chance to buy the leased building outright from NAMA. It was 2015, but there was a series of disasters, and it ended up in the hands of a corporate landlord from whom they had to rent the building for the guards on an extended lease because they were so slow getting the new building, and they had to pay penalties when they left the lease early. We think. They can correct us, by the way. The OPW 51551 is our text, oliver@rte.ie. And that mistake cost millions more. There was another measuring error which led to more overpayment of rent on a building for the Revenue Commissioners in Galway. This is around 2016, 2017. Very same error as the Department of Health issue. They overpaid rent by about 2 million, we reckon, there. And then the same state body was responsible and is still responsible for one of the most infamous vacant plots of land in the country. It's Hammond Lane. It's in Dublin city centre, right bang smack in the middle of the capital. Bought by the OPW in the late 90s from Maguire and Patterson. Yes, the matches manufacturing people. And because of dithering across several departments, not just OPW, various feck-ups and carry on, we're still waiting for spades to hit the ground, which is supposed to be a new family courts complex. But it meant that place has been vacant for 26 years and counting, and no accountability there. So it is. There's been a series of errors for generally a good organisation, and you nearly expect people would think the OPW stands for Ogis Poxy Wastels Wasting. But it doesn't. That would be very unfair. We would never say that. It is the Office of Public Works, a very revered and grand institution, has been around since 1981. And maybe if we were to spend any more money on the OPW, we could buy them a ruler and a calculator, or one of those mathematical sets with the compass and the triangles and things like that. So there we go. Hopefully someone will be. Is there going to be a count now on how many bicycles? Maybe if Cathal McCann is listening to us, he'll tell us how many bicycles are in the beautiful lean-to. I don't want to call it a shed because there's just no walls. It's just not a shed. Now, welcome back. A Wexford woman has taken the bodybuilding world by storm. She finished second out of 18 competitors in a pure elite transformation category. It was in a contest happening in Manchester. Tricia Rooney, good morning.
Good morning.
And well done to you, by the way.
Thanks a million.
Was you very proud of yourself?
Oh, very. Still a shock to me.
What exactly made you want to kind of take part in a bodybuilding competition?
Well, I started with a friend of mine. She trains in powerlifting. So as I was losing weight at the time, I got into the powerlifting first.
Yeah.
I fell in love with weights. And then I done my first powerlifting competition back in November 2022. Mm-hmm. I placed third in that. I was always keen to try the bodybuilding side because the strength it takes mentally and physically to do it, obviously with my background that we'll talk about soon.
Yeah.
It was something I definitely wanted to throw myself into to try, so I did.
What is it about the because people love the cardio, some people go running and they get the heart up rate and so on, but obviously weightlifting did something for you.
It did. It's not just the strength it gives you physically, but it's the strength it gives you mentally as well. And
really? It's
a great sport to take your anger out on.
Is that it? Because of the strain, every bit of you straining.
Exactly. Just let it all go.
Oh, God, that's a good tip. That's a good tip for the rest of us. Now, you're a young woman and you have quite a lot that's happened in what you refer to there as your background.
Yes. Yes. So I am a domestic abuse survivor. I was in an abusive relationship. I had gotten out in April 2020. So it was lockdown. So lockdown would have been very scary and very hard on me at that time.
Yeah. I'm really sorry you went through that. So your abuser was convicted but not jailed. Were you happy with that outcome?
I was, because it wasn't about having him jailed or anything. It was just to be heard, and it's one thing that isn't enough of in this country, unfortunately. But I didn't just stand for me. I stood for every other woman that's going through it still to this day. So that's all I wanted. I just wanted my story to be heard and hope it'll give strength and courage to other women that are out there that are suffering.
Do you know, it absolutely does, because these stories always help people because they feel hopeless and trapped and that they'll never get out and they can't see a way of getting out.
Exactly.
But you found your strength and you found your route to survival.
I did. It took a while, but I got there in the end.
You have a lovely phrase you've used, which I've seen elsewhere, and it says, because you want people to hear your story and you don't want to end up blaming yourself, which is what people will do in these situations. You said, we mm-hmm. were just loved wrongly by the wrong people and made to believe that's how we should be loved.
Exactly.
Can you break that down for me, if you will?
So because I was in an abusive relationship, you think this is normal, or that outburst is normal, or did I say something, or was that my fault? And you are made to believe that it is your fault because you're being manipulated at the end of the day. Yeah. And then there's a thing called love bombing. Oh, I'm sorry, I'll never do it again. It's the same old thing. And then now that I'm married, I'm with a man that he'll open the car door for me. He's so loving and affectionate. And it's like, when you get that side of it, it is mentally, what's the word? It does play on your mind nearly of what's he looking for, if that makes sense.
I see what you mean.
It's like there's a catch to his kindness, even though there isn't. But it's like when you're loved for so long by that wrong person and then you're actually loved properly, that would be it for me.
You've escaped the narcissism and now you're loved correctly by the right people.
Exactly. Okay. Now, there's days I'm still healing. I'm still finding myself who I am. And that's going to take a while. But
of course.
It's to be loved like that. That's how it should be. You shouldn't have to be walking on eggshells. You shouldn't be nervous. Do you know, love shouldn't hurt.
Yeah. We could even hear in your voice, you're just a strong person. You're obviously very different to what you were in the past.
Oh, definitely. Mentally, I'm way stronger than what I was.
Good. Now, you were taking part in this bodybuilding competition. It's a transformation category. So presumably you come later to this than others.
Yes. So it's my category wasn't so on the muscle side. It was your journey as a person and how much weight you have lost and transformed yourself mentally as well.
Does that mean you have to kind of describe to a panel of judges?
No, so you kind of, when you're entering it, you give a brief detail about yourself and there's a lady on the side with a microphone and she was like, this was Trisha. And then my picture came up at my heaviest. And she was like, this is Trisha now. And then I'd walk out. So as you're doing your poses, she's telling the judges a bit about yourself.
And so you finished second out of 18 competitors, presumably from all across here and over in England.
Yeah, so I didn't think I was going to get to compete because I was actually in hospital the day before.
Really?
So I was very ill for a long time and I told them, I have to go, I have to do this. So they said, they let me out and told me I had to be back Monday, which I flew out on the Saturday and I was back the Monday. So I checked back into hospital on the Monday. I was in there for a week. I got diagnosed with Addison's disease, which I'm still adapting to now today. But I didn't think when I was on the stage, I felt ill. But once I seen that picture come up, I was like, no, I have to do her proud.
Ah, do yourself proud.
Exactly.
Do you say it was Addison's disease? What's that?
Yes. So it's actually a rare condition. I'm still trying to learn about it myself. So I was told before I flew over that my kidneys weren't working properly. So that was kind of scary. And then when I came back, they'd done more results. So it was like the gland that sits on top of your kidneys was damaged. I had tissue damage because it was there for so long. It was misdiagnosed.
Right.
So I don't release a steroid in my body like everyone else. So I have to take meds and injections to put that steroid into my body.
Life is throwing all sorts of challenges at you.
Yes, one by one.
What is the proudest part of your transformation or the bit of the transformation that you're most proud of?
Strength-wise, mentally, as a human being and a person that I have grew into today, I am so proud of myself.
Because the weight loss is one thing, but it's how you sound to us now. We don't know the old Trisha. We know the new one.
Exactly.
And
yeah.
You're in a very, very happy place.
I am. I'm in a safe place. And that's what I should be for everyone that does suffer. Like, we all deserve our safe place.
Yeah. You're also a successful businesswoman.
I am. I'm a hairdresser. So I work for myself, which is great because I get to work around the kiddies, which can be a nightmare at times, but
I'd say. And you might as well since you're on the radio, you might as well give a shout out to your business. Where can people go to support you in Wexford?
So I'm actually mobile at the minute. Some people come to me, I can go to them, whichever they prefer. I'm located now in Ballyclan at the minute, but they'll find it on Sleek Hair page, or my personal page would be Trisha Andrew, since I got married last year.
Congratulations. Yeah. You got married last
Thank
year.
Thank you.
Because I think people will want to, they'll know that you're good at it because I'm looking at your photograph here and the outfit is quite something. It's a diamante bikini, is that
how you would say? Oh my God. It was so heavy. It was so heavy to carry around. It was but it was beautiful. She'd done a really good job.
And it's blue and white?
Yes, and bits of silver. So we kind of went for the Ice Queen look.
Ice Queen look. Is there a reason for that?
No, I just like the theme of it.
You've got a beauty salon, I suppose. You know what you're doing. The tan looks like a really important thing in this competition as well.
It is, and I am still to this day trying to scrub it off me. It's still in patches all over me, and it's been so hard to get off.
You're a salon owner, surely you know some kind of magic trick.
I'm thinking bleach on a Brillo pad, but I don't think it's a good idea.
Suddenly business is going down.
Yeah.
No, it's not a good idea. So it's been sprayed onto you.
Oh my
very
God,
well.
It's tacky, but it was a brilliant experience. Like the federation itself and the women that are there, it's like, it's not a competition nearly. Everyone is just one community. And we still keep in contact, which is great. Yeah. Like, so I'm definitely looking forward to going back and doing another one. I'd love to do Mums That Lift. There's the tattoo one.
But that's a real tattoo, not a transfer sort of thing on your right leg, is it?
No, I have a few of them, but that one has to be covered up.
Is it okay? Why is that?
That was 19 and stupid.
Not even the Brillo pad and bleach is going to remove
that. No, unfortunately not.
But you have the 19 and stupid one, which tells its own story, and you've got newer ones, do you?
Yeah, I do have other ones. I have one on my back, which is the one for my strength that I've gained. So it's a butterfly on one side and the other wings are grown into flowers. So it's just what I've been through over the last couple of years.
Oh my God, you've got meaning right on the skin.
Yes.
Lovely. Listen, Tricia Rooney, I'll leave you go, and congratulations again for doing so well in that bodybuilding competition in Manchester.
Thanks a million.
And thanks a million for everything you've done for yourself and other women.
Thanks a million.
It's not easy, but I'm delighted to hear that you are surviving strongly.
And, I am.
And continued good best wishes to you on your recovery.
Thanks a million.
Pleasure talking to you.
And you, Oliver.
Now, global best-selling author Robert Harris has a brand new novel out, Precipice. It is set in 1914 with Europe on the brink of the Great War, and it tells the extraordinary story of British Prime Minister Herbert Asquith and his obsessive affair with a significantly younger socialite. It's a thrilling story nonetheless, and it uses new research which reveals how this manic romance in many ways threatened Asquith's political career and the security of the empire at a time of war. There's also substantial Irish interest in the story as well, which I'm glad to say, and Robert Harris is with us. Welcome.
Thanks, Oliver. Good to be here.
You've always been fascinated, I believe, by this bizarre entanglement between a 62-year-old Prime Minister, is he?
And yeah, 61. Yeah, it's not
61.
Much different. Yeah.
And Venetia Stanley is...
Who's 26 when the novel opens.
26. So you've been reading this for a couple of years? It's been...
Yeah, a long time. Maybe 10 years, perhaps more than that. And Because I found them a fascinating family, the Asquiths. There were so many of them. And I thought maybe I could write a saga about them all. But then I thought that there were too many to follow all the characters. And really, what became more and more interesting to me was this relationship between Asquith and this young woman. He wrote her 560 letters in all. She kept all of them. Sometimes he wrote to her three times a day.
Extraordinary.
And sent her secret information. He was absolutely besotted with her. And he destroyed all the letters she sent to him. And I realised, simple arithmetic, he liked a letter from her every day. Maybe she didn't make it all the time, but it means she must have destroyed 350 letters. And I thought, well, here's something I can do. I can recreate her side of the correspondence and show her side of the affair.
And it's beautifully done. And the reason you're doing that is because you think she's such a significant figure in British history, if not perhaps European history, and that you wanted her kind of story to be told properly.
Yeah, I wanted to write a novel with a strong female character. I wanted to do it for a number of years. And she presented the opportunity because she was no fool. He spent a lot of time with her, took a lot of advice from her because she was very clever. And I thought she did exercise influence clearly. And when she broke off the affair in May 1915, Asquith went to pieces. And literally less than a week later, folded the government and invited the Tories to join him. And there was never a Liberal government again. He was sort of heartbroken. And this has been underplayed by historians. So I think responding to the family who have always, you know, tried to make it sound as though this is a purely platonic affair and not that important.
They've always, historians have dismissed this as an insignificant dalliance.
Yes, Roy Jenkins, who was a great friend of mine, actually, who published a big biography 60 years ago revealing the existence of these letters, said it was no more of a distraction than Lloyd George's hymn singing. Well, it certainly was. I don't think there's any doubt.
And it's all happening at a time of monumental history. I mean, it's almost comic in a way when we're reading his letters, which in the book are his actual letters, all his words.
Yes.
I mean, give us an idea of just how... it's slightly insane, isn't it, really, the things he's sending to this young woman?
Well, they're all very passionate. They're all my dearest, darling, beloved. One of them ends, do you know how much I love you? No, just multiply the stars by the sands. So there's all this romantic stuff, which Roy Jenkins completely left out.
Yeah.
And then he sends his secret information. And another reason I wanted to write the book, actually, is the way they used to get away together was to take an hour and a half drives once a week in his car.
Yeah.
This car is not like a modern car, I discovered when I set out to write the novel. Uh-huh. It had a fixed glass screen between the passengers and the chauffeur. There was a curtain you could draw across this screen. You communicated as the passengers with the driver by a push-button console that lit up on the windscreen, and there were blinds on all the other windows. So now that explains why they went for an hour and a half drive every Friday afternoon. He used to, apart from whatever else happened, he used to show her top-secret telegrams in the summer of 1914. They were called flimsies. They were carbon copies.
I love that detail, yes.
Yeah, and he would screw them up in a ball after he'd show them, throw them out of the moving car window. And these started to be handed in by members of the public in Marlow, in Henley-on-Thames, St James's Park, and only five people received them. They were Asquith, the Foreign Secretary, Sir Edward Grey, Winston Churchill, who was head of the Navy, Kitchener, head of the Army, and the Colonial Secretary. And so there was a leak inquiry.
How sensitive is the information?
Sensitive, because these are decrypted ambassadorial telegrams, and if the Germans had found them, they would have broken the British diplomatic codes. So it was a serious thing, and I thought, here is where I can invent someone. I'll invent the poor guy who has to go and try and find out why these have started appearing all over southern England. So he's this policeman is the only invented character in the novel.
Yes, yeah, and that adds the thrilling aspect.
Well, it gave me a procedural thing, and it also gave me a way in for the modern reader, you know, into this extraordinary enclosed world of privilege. She came from a very rich family, all this kind of country house weekend world that they inhabited. He's an outsider looking in.
This is your kind of trademark, isn't it? You've got the truth going on there, and you've got the entertaining side of the fiction. It's education by stealth in many ways, isn't it?
Well, you know, I was a journalist, and for me, there's nothing really beats reality. I mean, you know, and so part of the pleasure I've found as a writer is to come across stories and then let them kind of sit in my mind for a year or two and see if there's some way that I could write about them. Not all my books are like that, but the last one about the regicides was, and this one is too. The spectacle of this guy in this extraordinary time when they kind of wandered into a war, they didn't know what was going to happen. The novel follows the first 9 months of the war from Asquith's point of view. The telegrams coming across his desk, the cabinet meetings, doesn't go to the front. It's just from the Whitehall perspective. And he sent top secret documents through the open post to her. There were 12 deliveries a day in London in 1914, amazingly.
Yeah.
And so she, you know, she got cabinet details, she got secret troop movements, you know, he sent it all to her.
In fact, he sends so many documents, sometimes he needs the documents.
Well, this is part of his downfall, was that he sent her a document from Lord Kitchener saying, I've spoken to the British Army in France and they have enough shells for their next attack. There'd been a great scandal about the shortage of ammunition. And he made a speech to 5,000 ammunition workers in Newcastle saying there's never been a shell shortage. And then, of course, he realised he'd got it wrong. He was just saying the next attack they'd be all right. So he'd sort of lied to the country.
Extraordinary. The newspaper coverage of this novel, very unusual for a novel, are about revelations, discoveries of true history. literally saying that this is the first time people have discovered the details. Why is that? What? Because these letters were sort of known.
Well, yes, they were. They were discovered after Venetia Stanley's death in 1948. They were discovered by her daughter, Judy, and she realised their importance. She had no idea of her mother's affair with the Prime Minister. So then she owned the physical letters, but the Asquith family controlled the literary content.
Right.
She told the family about it. They made transcripts. They gave them to Roy Jenkins, but under certain conditions. So he played down the affair, quite frankly. That was in 1964. 1982, a scholarly edition of half the letters was published. But again, they were at pains to suggest this was not a physical affair, which frankly is nonsense, given the nature of the two individuals.
You've just described the bedroom on wheels.
The bedroom on wheels, which no one else had ever taken the trouble to discover. So, and then there are letters, important letters, which are missing, in particular the last two paragraphs of the novel, where Asquith explicitly says he might well not have formed a coalition and folded the Liberal government if only she had been around to advise him, because he relied on her judgment. He felt he could trust her in a way that he couldn't trust other colleagues, I think.
Good Lord. The relationship itself is kind of shocking in any era, really, isn't it? Because he's a man in the 60s. He's married. He's on his second marriage.
Yes, he has he has seven children.
He has seven children. And one of those children is... this is how he knows Venetia Stanley, I presume, because she's friends with his daughter.
His daughter, Violet, they were best friends, Violet and Venetia. So, yes, in the modern era, it would be... I mean, it would have been a huge scandal in 1914, but these days it would have been a completely career-ending scandal immediately. And, of course, it would have come to light. But Asquith could travel... In the novel, he goes on train journeys, walks through the streets, completely unrecognised, even though he's been Prime Minister for, six, 7 years by this point. Mm. So he was able to get away with it in a way that no politician would be able to do now.
And Venetia Stanley, she's very interesting because she's very rich, from a very wealthy family. They have houses all around the place, and we have great fun in the novel visiting each of them at the parties they go. Very spoiled.
Yes, very spoiled. A woman looking for a purpose in life. She drifted around a kind of rakish society set known as the coterie. She, I think, liked to shock her family. They half guessed what was going on, I think. I think she liked the risk of it. I think it's important to say she's no victim, in my view. Mm-hmm. I think she was a strong person, and when she got bored with Asquith, she moved to finish the relationship. So she was always, to a degree, in control. It wasn't like he was her boss and she was a secretary and he was predatory. She was a social superior in many ways.
And in the novel, she's kind of exasperated by the sheer volume of letters having to reply she's doing nothing, but the Prime Minister is sending so many letters.
Yeah, to begin with, I think, it amused her. But as the war turned worse and worse for the British, he became more and more desperate and started sending her letters three times a day. He'd like to wake up to a letter from her on his bedside table. He'd write to her at the end of the morning and tell her what had happened in Cabinet. At the end of the afternoon or early evening, he might walk to his club, the Athenaeum, sit in the library with a whiskey and soda and write to her about what had happened during the day. And then at midnight, lying in bed, he'd scrawl a pencil letter to her. So he was sending her three letters a day. Well, she simply couldn't cope with the flow, I don't think, and started to look for ways of getting out of this.
It's just incredible, given the backdrop of what's
going on.
Oh,
yes, and given the thing really comes to the part that's shocking is the way that the terrible Dardanelles expedition, which the Allies launched, that the British alone lost 32,000 men, British and Irish, I should say, because, of course, Irish were fighting at that time, and 110,000 men died in all. And at the crucial meeting where Churchill presented the plans and this was agreed, he spent half an hour of that meeting, we know, writing to Venetia. 3:30 p.m., my darling, I'm in a war council meeting. I'll pick you up next Tuesday from Cynthia's. Oh, I see. No, it's the following Tuesday that you're at Cynthia's. So clearly he's got his diary.
Incredible.
Then it goes on 4 p.m., Winston talking, very interesting. We'll tell you all about it when I see you. So we have a sort of minute-by-minute record of his distraction.
If you made it up, we wouldn't believe it.
No, exactly.
Because Winston Churchill is a significant character in this. He's about 40...
he's 39, I think.
He's liberal at this stage.
Yes.
And he's the First Lord of the Admiralty. And, of course, he's very involved. He's scapegoat, really, isn't he, for that failed attack on Constantinople?
Yes, he is. Although he was certainly the prime mover of it, and he was the one who wanted to keep pressing on with it, even as it got more and more mired in trouble.
Even when he knew he didn't have the troops.
It was crazy. I mean, we were trying to do it with 1,500 men, take Constantinople, ended up sending 80,000, I think it was, and losing a lot of ships. And just, it was like Vietnam, really, for the Americans. We never had a clear objective. We never asked ourselves how many men it would take. So that was stupendous folly. And Churchill was very belligerent. He wanted the First World War. I mean, he was keen for it. Whereas another character in the book, who I really enjoyed writing, Lord Kitchener, warned Asquith right from the start, because everyone's saying, oh, it's going to be over by Christmas. They went in almost light-hearted, but he said, when he was asked how long the war would last, he said, well, it'll last till 1917 at least, because we need to raise an army of 2 million men, and that will take us 3 years.
He predicts every step, really, doesn't he?
Yeah, he knew what he was talking about, and he didn't want to be Secretary of State for War, because he knew what was coming.
He was trying to go back to Egypt.
Yes, he was Consul General in Egypt, and that was a much more cushy and agreeable billet than being in charge of the British Army.
He's a fearsome character here. You mentioned the Irish question is very prominent in the story as well, because, of course, that's the build-up to World War One. And is this the first time you've featured Ireland? There's even the scene in Dublin.
Yes. There is Ireland, obviously, in the book I wrote about Cromwell and the Regicide. A drive-by shooting, I suppose one would describe that as.
A novel that confused Irish readers, we have to say. Which side are we on, the Royalists Cromwell?
But this Ireland is important here because in the summer of 1914, all the British political establishment could think of was home rule for Ireland, which the Irish nationalists who propped up the Liberal government were insisting was introduced. And so when the Archduke was assassinated in Sarajevo and the international crisis began to blow up, there was some sense, some people were relieved because it would mean the Irish Empire could be postponed yet again.
Yeah.
But Venetia wrote a very good letter to Asquith, which I'm able to put in the book because we know it. She said, that's like saying the best way to cure a headache is to cut off your head.
Yeah.
And he says, I liked that remark. So it gives you a flavour of how funny she was and clever.
Very smart.
Yeah.
He even comes back from his trip to Dublin and tells her casually, you pick the next...
Oh, yes. Lord Aberdeen was the viceroy. I mean, I did find this weird because he really engineered the trip to Dublin to speak to a mass audience to raise morale and troops because it meant that he could stay with her and her family near Holyhead
that
on the way
astounding.
Out and on the way back.
Yeah. So he travels all the way to Dublin just so he can stop on Holyhead, which is where her kind of summer home is.
Yes, and that's extraordinary. But it was really weird for me to write about him staying at the Viceregal Lodge in Phoenix Park and to think that this...
It's now the building where the President of Ireland lives.
And this is not that long ago. I mean, it's just extraordinary. So this is the last real flickerings of the great Victorian imperial project.
And Irish historians particularly would be delighted with the mention of an often forgotten shooting which happens on Bachelor's Walk in Dublin on the Quays here in 1914 with the Scottish Borderers, is it?
Yes, so that was another great bit of chaos for Asquith to deal with, because at this time, following the Curragh Mutiny, he was not only Prime Minister, he was also Secretary of State for War, so he had to withdraw the soldiers that had fired on the crowd, and then there was a debate where they came off pretty badly, the government. They were mauled by the opposition. So, Ireland was his great preoccupation. Mm-hmm. And this other huge conflict was a sort of small dark cloud on the horizon that suddenly became enormous.
I love that line where you say politics is just replacing one problem with another.
Exactly. There's just
one hell of a problem.
And the next one, please. Yes, they come over the hill one after the other.
But there's extraordinary detail about dealing with the dreary parishes of Fermanagh and in Tyrone as well, because the Ulstermen come calling on Asquith. By the way, incidentally, on that shooting that happened in Dublin, I was reading, I think 3 or 4 people died. One of the people shot is the father of a very famous folk singer in Ireland, Luke Kelly.
Really?
He was in the Dubliners. So extraordinary kind of Irish connections.
Yeah.
It's things like the Flimsies and also the door on Downing Street is green in this
The year. Door was green. There was no security. You could walk up to Downing Street. He would be fumbling with his key to go in. He was known as Squiffy because he liked to drink on top of everything else. And and they had a kind of like 20 servants in Downing Street. And it was just such a vanished era. Taxi drivers didn't know where Downing Street was.
He uses just normal taxis.
Yes, there's a great scene in it, again, true, where he, in a desperate attempt to avoid war, a telegram comes in from the Kaiser, complaining about the Tsar, and he suddenly thinks, oh, this is at midnight, and he suddenly thinks, oh, maybe we could persuade the Tsar to stop mobilisation. So he scrawls a reply from the King, goes to Downing Street, goes from Downing Street, hailing a cab to Buckingham Palace, wakes up the King at 1 o'clock in the morning, who comes down in his dressing gown, shows him the telegram. The King puts it to the Kaiser, to the Tsar, the King puts "Dear Nicky" at the beginning of it and "Yours, Georgie" at the end.
Because they're cousins.
Yes. And Asquith staggers back to his bed and lies awake at 2 o'clock in the morning thinking of Venetia as he writes to her. I mean, it was a gift, really, for a novelist, the whole thing.
I have to say, you, probably because of your background, which you're very, very proud of, you grew up in a council estate in Nottingham, is that correct?
Yes.
There's quite a lot of coverage of these people having a fine time dining, picnics on the beach, just constantly doing nothing, really. I mean, and the fictional bit gives us a nice kind of snarky coverage, which is spot on, about the gardeners earning threepence
an hour. Yeah, I needed that framing, I realised. Otherwise, everyone just takes this world for granted and the modern reader would just recoil from it. So I needed this character who's got them under surveillance, is investigating their relationship, intercepting their letters, to give us some perspective to the story. Yes, that character is me, really, or all of us, looking astonished, mouth open, at what these people are getting up to.
Yeah, with the gates all closed, and because their world does change.
Oh yes, I mean it's haunting. Actually, the Venetia Stanley's family, they had a 64-bedroom mansion in Cheshire, Alderley Edge.
Yeah.
They had a huge castle, Penrhos, next to Holyhead, and they had a huge mansion in London off Portland Place. Only the mansion in London survives. The rest were all gone soon after after the 30s. The whole economic system that supported that way of life collapsed. This is the last glimpse of these people before the clouds roll in and the Edwardian summer days are gone.
Yeah, it's just lovely the way you blend that in, almost subtly. And by the way, we're giving a lot away about history here, but there's still quite a lot of action because you've got Paul Deamer, the detective.
I've got the policeman and
whose
also...
His brother is at the front.
His brother's at the front, and it's just watching these characters. They're like characters on the deck of the Titanic, really, that's just starting to go down, something that happened during when Asquith was Prime Minister.
Oh, yeah.
And really... I became very fond of her and interested in her and her desire to escape from the constricted life she was obliged to lead.
You had a lot of journalistic fun with this one.
Yeah, yes, I know, especially I felt like a News of the World man, really, when I was investigating the car.
We have
and trying to imagine what was happening in the back of it. But it's sort of prurient in a way, but history turns on these sorts of affairs and the longings and the passions of people in those huge jobs are no different from those of ordinary people. Indeed, they may be more intense because they're more intense individuals.
Venetia Stanley, she obviously has family descendants
that
are around.
She has one granddaughter.
Does she?
Yes.
Do you know what she's made of the story?
She's very enthusiastic. She helped me a lot, actually, and gave me permission to use the letters. And I'm doing events publicising the book with her. Her name's Anna Mathias. She's extremely nice. Her mother died young when she was still a child, and she's the only one left. It's rather a sad, end to the whole story.
Especially such a remarkably intelligent woman that Venetia was. Anna Mathias told The Observer she was completely delighted with the novelistic treatment because it brings her relative to life. The Observer, by the way, an old haunt of yours?
Yes, yes. I was political editor of The Observer, and I learned a lot, which has helped me, you know, in writing the novels over the years. I'm a journalist, still a journalist at heart, really. Most of my friends are journalists from the time when I worked at the BBC all the time and newspapers.
Journalists through novel form. or something.
Yeah, I just find them their company more conducive than that of novelists, to be honest.
It seems like you missed the job of journalism and that's why you kind of are still doing it in this way.
No, I don't, to be honest with you. I did journalism and I got a lot out of it, but I never enjoyed it nearly as much as writing novels. I think I was a novelist working as a journalist rather than as a journalist who turned his hand to writing novels, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
This was always what I was going to do. I think that was a preparation for this.
It says on Wikipedia you were 30 when you became the political editor of The Observer. Is that correct?
Yes. Well, actually, I was 29, but it seems immodest to point that out.
I think I've got every age wrong by a year or so.
Well, Wikipedia is wonderful, but, you know, there are
not to be trusted, which is why I was fact-checking. That's a remarkable success.
Well, thank you. I mean, I was started young, 21. I went to work at the BBC straight from university. I did that for 8 years. And then Anthony Howard, a great journalist who was deputy editor, said, did I want to come and do the political job? Because I'd written biography of Neil Kinnock and I'd sort of always followed politics. So I went and did that for 2 years. And then I moved to the Sunday Times as a columnist. Mm. I wasn't a very good news reporter, to be perfectly honest.
Really?
You know, big stories would be going on under my nose and I'd be sort of wandering around with a book.
You're able to spot stories now that have been ignored for 100 years.
Yes, this is more the pace I can work at.
Okay. Was everyone in your family as successful as you? Were you all...
Well, not really. I mean, insofar as I was the only member of my family who ever went to university, I was the first to go. Right. And so I was a bit of an outlier, really. I owe a lot to my mother and father, huge amount, because they both left school at 14, but they were both very intelligent and both. So we grew up in a house where books were read and they took us to exhibitions and museums and, you know, they were aspirant working class, if you know what I mean. And nowadays, of course, they get much more of a chance. In those days, they didn't.
What did they do?
My father was a printer, so my earliest memories really are sitting behind these huge presses on a Saturday morning, playing with huge sheets of paper that he let me use. I think that's very much partly why I became a writer. I had the smell of printer's ink in my nostrils from childhood. And my mother was just a housewife, you know, stayed at home.
She worked at home?
Yeah.
Your dad, he got polio, was it?
He had polio when he was a baby, when he was 18 months, and they tried electric shock treatment and all. I mean, it must have been awful for him.
Dreadful,
he got it in the same epidemic as Franklin D. Roosevelt in the 1920s. So that affected his life. It meant he could never really play sport. He was a strong swimmer, but otherwise he couldn't play sport. So we never had that. You know, he was never tossed a ball around or anything like that.
Oh,
we talked about politics and... famous story in the family that when I was 6 years old, you know, there was a parents' evening and my parents came to see examples of work which were pinned up around the classroom and everyone else, what we did in our holidays or my pet hamster and so on. My essay was called Why Me and My Dad Don't Like Sir Alec Douglas Hume. And in a way, I went on writing that in The Observer and The Sunday Times ever afterwards.
You've been very, very fortunate, haven't you, with the screen treatment of your work?
Yes, I have. I've had nine, things turned into films or TV series, and most of them have been pretty good. And the forthcoming one, Conclave, looks like it might be the best.
This is going
all.
To be, isn't it?
Yes. It's one of those things that is a great thing that can happen to you completely. Yeah, I mean, the novel very closely.
The papal thriller.
Yeah.
People will know.
Yes, it's with Ralph Fiennes as the kind of dean of the College of Cardinals, and Stanley Tucci is in it, and Isabella Rossellini is the nun.
John Lithgow. There's an Irish actor in there, Breen F. O'Byrne.
Yes, and it is directed by the director who did All Quiet on the Western Front, who
Edward
won the Oscar.
Burker. You must be thrilled when he came on board.
Yeah, it was just a sort of everything kind of came together. together. It's taken 8 years, I would say, incidentally, right. And people have been attached to it and gone away from it. But it has a very good producer, Tessa Ross, who was determined to see it through. And there we are. So, yeah.
The trailer looks amazing.
The trailer is fantastic. I saw it a year ago when it wasn't quite finished. I haven't seen the final finished version yet.
That's coming out in November, so right in time for award season. That's how confident they are.
They seem to be very confident about it. I get very superstitious. I sort of cross my fingers and touch wood and whistle tunelessly whenever people talk about things like that.
But you must get quite a buzz.
Yeah, it's great. It's like being a grandfather, which has just happened to me. You know, it's handed to you and then you can hand it back. You know, sort of, I'm responsible and yet curiously not responsible. So it's the best sort of relationship.
It's akin to being a granddad. That's quite a high, high compliment. Precipice is made for a movie.
Well, let's hope. I haven't sold it yet. So if there's any film producers out there listening...
Because Munich, of course, which is Jeremy Irons,
yes,
as Peace in Our Time, Neville Chamberlain, that was very, very well received, wasn't it?
Yeah, as you say, I have been fortunate. You know, things can go wrong. I didn't think much of Fatherland, to be honest with you.
But
Enigma, the Tom Stoppard did the screenplay, and you know, I think that's a pretty good film.
Precipice is the first time you've tackled the Great War.
Yes, it is.
It is. I'm surprised by that.
I've never set a book there before, and it's different. It's not kind of barbed wire trenches and all of that. It's the politics, the diplomacy that tries to avoid it, and then the politics and the strategy as the whole thing starts to go terribly wrong.
It's the best treatment of history because it has our kind of jaws dropping and almost laughing darkly at it, and yet it's real.
Yes, and I worried about writing characters like Kitchener, but when it came to it, because I'm writing from Asquith's point of view, these characters come in out of the room and go out of the room, and I just follow what he thinks of them, see them through his eyes. And Kitchener, 6'2", the great imperial soldier
he'll
with
be hard
staring
to cast.
Blue eyes because he's had some accident.
Kenneth Branagh on stilts, maybe.
Yeah, so I don't know who can be him. Asquith's wife, Margot, who we haven't mentioned, who was quite a formidable woman, she said of Kitchener, not a great man, but a great poster. This is a typical Margot Asquith remark.
She gets great lines in this. Yes. Okay, and some of them are true, heard on the dinner table. Robert Harris, thank you so much for your time. I enjoyed our conversation. It's called Precipice. It's already out and about. You don't have to do much to push these things anymore, surely. Enjoy your trip to Dublin. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
Now, breakdancing made its Olympic debut in Paris, but unfortunately the story that people connected with the most was one of mockery and a bit of negativity, given the abuse that was attracted and directed towards Ray Gunn, the infamous Australian B-girl who received a lot of criticism for her performance. Toby Omotesho reckons the saga around that video has been misrepresented, and he's here to talk about how he discovered breaking, and he's also going to talk about an exciting event that's happening in Limerick in the middle of September. Toby, you're very welcome. Thanks for travelling up from Limerick for us.
Listen, Thanks for having me.
Toby Omotesho. I'm sorry if I...
not at all.
Omotesho. You were halfway through explaining. Oh,
yeah.
Omotesho.
Oh, yeah, Omotesho. So with the T,
Tesho.
You put the T and H together, so he's like Omotesho.
Oh, very good.
Yeah, yeah.
It didn't do too bad at all.
Yeah.
And you're both Nigerian and Irish. Is that the
identity? Yes, yes, yeah, exactly. I was born in Nigeria, but I grew up here. I've been here about 27 years now.
Oh, really? What age did you know? You were a child then, obviously. Small
yeah,
child.
Yeah, 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 exactly. I was like 9. When we first moved here to Kildare, my dad is a Norse, so he came here.
Very good. We need them.
Exactly. So he was in here many years ago. So yeah.
And it's was it Selbridge?
Selbridge. Yeah.
What was life like growing up there?
Selbridge. Can you imagine back then? You know, back in like 1999. Actually, 1998, 1999. There was nothing there, only like cows and cattle.
Nothing.
Like absolutely nothing. to see where it's gone from.
That's true.
The boom. It's amazing. But there was nothing there. You know, it was just like cattle, fields and rain.
And it's a football mad place. So
football, yes.
You had no choice but to join in.
No choice. But unfortunately, back then they didn't fancy us. You know, people like me on the pitch back then. You know,
is
so
that right?
Yeah, exactly. So which was kind of like I would have been the best hurley player. Like if you see me with a hurley on my hand, boy. You know.
Well, you'd be the best hurley player in Kildare.
In Kildare,
might be too difficult, you know. But did you play football up until what age then?
Into
your teenage years?
About 15.
About 15?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And you stopped, why?
Yeah, it was just kind of difficult to keep going, you know, because, it is a very passionate sport. Now, you become more passionate when they see someone like me on the pitch, you know. So the abuse I was getting, so I, you know, it was just best to just kind of step down.
This is a few years after. This is into the noughties now, because when you're
exactly.
You were getting abuse.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. 2000, early 2000, exactly.
For being the black kid.
Yeah, the black kid on the pitch, you know. And I'm like, come on, guys, you know, I just have more suntan than he is, you know. That's
but I know you're laughing about it now, but it must have been pretty hard at the time.
Oh, no, to be honest, it was. And I think that deterred a lot of people, you know, actually joining the sport. The guy would have actually been more a multicultural space, you know, if it has been given the opportunity, or people has been given the opportunity. And there's amazing guy players now coming up in other fractions in the country.
Now,
yeah, exactly.
Sure. Exactly. What kind of things would they be saying to you?
Something like some I cannot recite on the radio, you know.
Really?
We might get cancelled, you know. But it was pretty shocking, you know, especially for a 12-year-old or a 13-year-old, 14-year-old or 15-year-old hearing that of parents more so. Which then
from the parents.
It's from the parents. It's
directed
from
at you, a child.
As a child. And then the child will see that learned behavior, and then they will mimic that, and then they grow up with that prejudice, and that prejudice doesn't serve society at all.
Would you try to fight back verbally, or would you just have to?
I was a very active kid with a lot of energy, so I did fight. To be honest, you know.
Did anybody stand up alongside you?
Of course, there was some adult that would have stood up, but everybody was learning. You know, it was the height of the Celtic tiger, and then there was an influx of, you know, immigrants and people that are more tanned than others, you know. So, you understand?
We had a lot of Nigerian immigrants, didn't we, during the boom years?
So, during the boom year. And it was because of the language, you know. It was the language. Ireland is one of the only English-speaking country in the EU, apart from the UK, you know. So the UK and Ireland that would have an influx of Nigerians that have come.
Okay. Well, I'm sorry you went through that. They obviously won because you left the sport.
And
the Selbridge.
I know.
Among your peers, were your friends, were they the white kids in Kildare, or did you have to become friends with the other Nigerians?
Funny enough,
there
wasn't a big Nigerian community back then.
No, okay.
But the travelling community. So, because we were the two people, so one of my friends, like my best mate at that time, was a traveler. It was from the community, and we were the two put back in the back of the class, you know.
So naturally, you become friends.
Yeah, yeah, and we become friends. Went to the halting site, you know. He knew the best spot, you know, to go and just to doss or to, you know, and he was he would have been, you know, the person that I would have hung around a lot with, you know. Yeah. And I didn't see him any different or anything, or like, it was just that was the way they have chosen to live, you know. And it wasn't any, you know, there wasn't any culture shock there. Mm-hmm. It was actually normal. He came to our house, you know, my parents know him. And we were the two people that were not almost accepted in society. So we bound together, you know.
Yeah.
And I think that's what kind of put me at peace, in a sense, you know, that, there's already prejudiced view against people that tend to look like them, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I'm much more me. So that's what kind of gave me a solace to be like, okay, maybe my turn will come. Maybe they let them sort that out within the traveling community.
Right.
You know?
Okay. Yeah. Are you saying there's prejudice?
As in, you know, what people would say to my friend.
You saw the problems for him.
For him as well. So I'm like, okay, if there's problem for him, definitely there'll be problems for me, you know. And he's been here far longer. Like, they are part of the land.
I see what you mean.
You know,
so
if they are part of the land, and if they are facing prejudice or injustice or whatever, then I'm much more me. You know, that
the
just,
ignorance has been here, unfortunately.
Well, exactly.
Now,
exactly.
It didn't hold you back because you were successful in your life. You now live in Limerick and you're an engineer.
Yeah, exactly. Successful. Yeah, I won't say so, somewhat, you know, I had to work.
Oh, you are. You mean automation, you know? Engineer. You have a good job in Johnson & Johnson.
Yeah. I mean, I worked hard. I paid my college in tuition, you know, went to college, you know, and then paid my way.
You didn't get free third level.
Because back then when we came, there was a mistake on the way I came into the country. I came in as a unification visa, which is just to join my father or my family.
Yeah.
But the state didn't know what stamp to assign to me back then, and then they assigned me a student visa. And we didn't know any better. We just got a stamp,
of course,
you know. Yeah. And there wasn't anybody to go to verify that or anything like that. It was just what was given to us, and then we rolled with that. And then so much so that I had to pay full tuition fees, and I didn't have access to grants or anything like that. So I paid. I was working. Working two jobs actually, and I had to go to college to pay my tuition fees.
You must have a very happy outlook in life that these knocks don't seem to have affected.
I won't say happy or sad. It's just that's my story, and I wear it. That's my part of that's my origin story.
How do you discover dance?
Actually, you know, if not for dance, probably I won't be here speaking to you. Obviously. You know, maybe it will be under other circumstances. Mm-hmm. But dance was my outlet, you know. And I feel like that was the thing, because I didn't want to go play soccer, you know, because every black lad was playing soccer. You know, you're black, you're expected to either play soccer or rap.
Right.
That's it, you know.
You're put in that box.
Yeah. Literally within society, you know. And
so you started doing something that no one else was doing.
So I just wanted to. I felt a different expression, and in my household, you know, is which I grew up, and I'm thankful for that household because there was always music and dance, and that's what really allowed us to air out whatever we were feeling inside, because there's just pumped up energy that needed to go somewhere, and it was dance. And I remember in birthday parties, like musical chairs or musical statues, and like little dance competition within the communities. And my parents used to put me into it, and I used to win them.
You loved it.
Yeah. Loved it. I loved it.
And then when you start dancing properly, who teaches you how to dance?
So that was in Carlo. It was on a open stage in for Culture Night. It was either Culture
really?
Night or Paddy's Day.
Yeah.
One of the, but there was a stage there, and I learned this. All the dance moves. Me and my mate, we learned it from a film called You Girl Served, and that movie changed my life because
great
I saw
dancing film.
It was a dance film, and I was like, oh, these are people, you know, the way they hat, you know, the gear, you know, they're cool, the way they talk, and at that age, you know, I was like 15, you know. I, you know, my hormones was raging. I was like, okay,
you're looking for a crowd.
You know, and then it makes you cool and things like that. So, and I wanted to belong more. So it was more a search of belonging, because in my space I wasn't in most of the spaces that I was in. I wasn't allowed, you know, be who I am, you know. And I was searching for that. I watched that movie. I told the lads, guys, let's go out. I can do this flip. And everybody was like, oh, Toby, you're going to break your leg. Will you stop?
Yeah.
You know, I was like, no. Come on. And then I done a backflip, you know?
Yeah.
And then everybody went nuts. Everybody was like, I was like,
very impressive.
I was like, this is what I want. This feeling is what I want to keep. And I want to know more of. Fast forward, the stage was there, an open stage that anybody could come up.
Mm-hmm.
So we went up to the stage. And we were busting out all the moves in the movie, you know, in the movie. And then all of a sudden, everybody thought we were professionals. We came from America, but we're just two lads from Carlo. You know, just
these incredible American
dancers. They thought we were like this.
Toby from Carlo.
Yeah, but I'm kid from Carlo, you know. You know, Flashy and Dashy, they used to call us, actually. You know,
It wasn't the worst name.
Yeah, Flashy and Dashy.
And so 20 years on, you're still doing the breaking.
Yeah, I'm doing, exactly.
What is the expression? What is it? Do you have to train separately, by the way, physically? Because it's an athletic performance.
It's
an
athletic,
dancing all the training?
So I dance, I train. Mm. I train minimum of 4 to 5 days a week for about an hour. That's my session.
Wow.
I've been doing that for 20 years.
Wow.
You know, so I've been training that long. Hence why I look this good, you know.
I'm sorry we're running out of time because your background was so fascinating.
Yeah, I know.
But tell us, if you can, in a minute, what you're going to be doing in Limerick and how people can go and enjoy watching you.
So in Limerick is part of a commission to This I Belong by LUL, which is the National Dance Company of Ireland. It's been set up new, and then there's four commissions in the four corners of the country. You know, Ulster, Munster, Connacht, and Leinster. And I'm in Munster, so I am literally
representing Limerick.
Representing Limerick, and it's a boombox. It's an initiative.
Boombox gathering, exactly. A revival of grassroots hip hop collective. It's the 14th of September.
14th of September.
Arthur's
yes.
Key Park.
Yes,
and
yes,
it's a,
yes.
It's a free event, actually.
It's a free event. It's open. It's outdoors, so we'll have graffiti, all the elements of hip hop, which is something that I would say saved me. You know, 14th of September.
Toby Amateo, thank you so much for coming into
thank
us.
Thank you for having
thanks
me.
For being such a happy chap and for recovering from all of that.
I know, right?
Take it easy. Good luck.